This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
You may have noticed that a lot of people are walking around a lot of places playing a certain game on their phones. Although it may seem that this game that shall not be named dropped from the heavens, it actually had to be developed by human beings, and people who can develop such things are in demand.
Overall, it's just a multi-billion dollar a year industry, and the gaming part is only a portion of that.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear about a new college degree in video game production. We'll also talk to a veteran teacher who wrote a book about helicopter parents and special snowflakes and other stuff. And we'll also spend an academic minute with music that makes us sad, which apparently is a good thing. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Colleges and universities across the country are struggling to cater to emerging industries such as video game design and virtual reality. Now, a college in upstate New York has created a new program to bridge virtual interactive media and real-world applications. The Best of Our Knowledge's Patrick Garrett spoke with Dr. Robert Geer, Senior Vice President and Chief Operating Officer at SUNY Poly, about the college's new bachelor's degree program in video game and interactive media design. They talked about why an engineering school is offering this particular degree.
We think of, when we think of game design, I think everyone has a picture of video games in their head. I think what people, certainly those that are closer to that, realize is that interactive media is so much broader than that. Overall, it's just a multi-billion dollar a year industry, and the gaming part is only a portion of that. So what this really is, it's an intersection. And the intersection that our program hits, which really is in our sweet spot, is sort of, it's the communication side, it's the technical side, and then it's the business side. And those are really the nexus of what we do as a polytechnic. So, in this program alone, there's sort of three concentrations. There's the software development and the interactive design, and that's really the, for the programmers, that's really the nuts and bolts of what you're doing when you're sitting behind a screen. There's the art and asset production, and this is really what gives it that phase. It's that communication side, it's the graphics side. And then what ties that up is essentially the market of the entrepreneurship. And you can think of that in a very simple way of just marketing a game. But in a larger sense, that's what's the heart of getting interactive media as sources and services, getting it out to the world. And so whether you're talking about Pokemon Go or you're talking about a more classic package type of, interactive software environment, that's the side of saying, okay, I've got a very nice capability here. Where does it fit? What market does it hit? Who are the people that need to have it? And we combine all of those elements into this major because we think when people go out into the world, these are the skills they need to have.
It's funny that you mentioned Pokemon Go, an augmented reality video game. One of the next, the next steps that people call it is virtual reality. Would the program go into that?
Absolutely. In fact, it's the focus is the virtual and augmented reality, sort of products and the capabilities. So that's really what this degree program explores. That's just one side of the concepts for this. If you're going to have a truly interactive media, which absolutely can be it for gaming, but now it starts to expand out to any level of communication. You could think virtual training, you can think online education, you can think even interacting between for an organization or a company that's spread out all over the world. It's essentially a virtual, you're having a virtual office where you're interacting with people, or a virtual production facility where you're interacting from people across the world, or operating rooms, the same type of approach. So that is absolutely at the heart of this, different ways of creating that communication. And in this case, it's, delivered or supported by technology.
When you say that virtual reality has this ability to basically penetrate into other markets, do you see virtual reality actually becoming something that other majors might teach, like being, kind of like how marketing and management kind of penetrates almost every single major in a sense? Do you see that being a thing maybe far in the future?
Well, I think that connection exists in programs now, at least the broader, more interdisciplinary types of programs do. I think the virtual reality, the augmented reality, is going to be a key tool because it allows people to immerse themselves in an environment which is not right in front of them. but it makes it right in front of them. And a great example is even on the technology side. Now, advanced manufacturing right now, whether it's an automobile, you know, a phone or a computer chip, what have you, can be some of the most complex processes. You want to actually train people how to do that, but you can't get them all around, you know, one piece of equipment. And so what training now does more than ever is put people into these, you know, into these virtual reality situations where they get to see everything they're going to be touching, and they get to be trained in it actually before they step on the floor. That the classic example is actually, you know, for our military defense, where they're, you know, plugged into a virtual reality so they can absorb all the information they need to in whatever sort of operation they happen to be in. So that we see as occurring over so many businesses in terms of how they operate. And once you get to there, you need to understand the marketing and the business side of it, because you need to know what customers can really use this. You know, what businesses can, how can it improve their bottom line to have access to this? So yes, I do think that when you have majors like this, bringing in the business and the marketing is essential, because that's where you really get to the entrepreneurship. You know, you have to be able to not only understand what the capabilities are in the technology, or in this case, the, you know, the software can give you, you need to know how to go out and find out where that can benefit customers. And so that's why we wrap it in, we sort of bundle that together.
There's other similar interactive media and game design programs across the country. What gives SUNY Poly, I guess, in your words, what would give you an edge over the other programs?
I think there's some good programs there. I think what makes us particularly valuable, you know, particularly good at it, is we've focused our, this program is actually, you know, in our communications side of our house. So we have people that are focused on communications, and they're leveraging the professionals we have in our computer science and in our arts and communication group. So we come at this focusing on, you know, interactive media and communication. So that, to me, that's the most critical piece about it, is that you're using really cutting-edge technology to shape how humans interact and communicate. So on one side of this, we'll have our folks that have been doing interactive media and working on gaming software and so forth and cyber technology. On the other side, you'll have some of our computer scientists that are studying how best to, for a machine interface to interpret facial expressions. And so it's bringing those, that nexus of people together to really to offer this program. That's what we think is our leg up, is that we are, this program is inherently interdisciplinary, brings both the social science aspect to it, the communications, and of course the technical end.
Since this is a, you know, emerging field and it's always changing, like you have virtual reality and augmented reality coming up, you also have mobile games, you have consoles that change, you know, once every 5 to 10 years, and then computers, which you can replace the parts on almost daily. So how do you teach to the ever-changing field?
I think the approach that we're taking here is sort of a tool-based approach. So when you create a program like this, you know, you're really basic, you know, you're building it on these fundamental principles, these fundamental concepts. And what lays over top of that is practice. Okay, so, you know, what tools do you have to do to implement these principles and to explore these concepts? It's that layer of practice which changes. So 5 years ago, you may not have had the technological power to motion grab or motion control, you know, by using hand motions or facial expressions to control an interface. So now you do, and that'll be better 2 years from now. And so those tools allow you to, you know, it's not going to change the basic principles and design concepts you have, but it makes the interface much richer. So whereas before you may have been limited in terms of how much information you could have across a particular interface, maybe it was only one way. Now, say between, like, you know, just your classic virtual reality goggles, now you have different ways. You can use motion capture to not only record, but to deliver information to. So those are the pieces that always keep changing. But it doesn't change the fact that you're looking for this interactive information interface. You're looking for information going both ways. And so the question is, you know, how rich can that interface be? And that's where this level of practice comes in, because you want to send out students that are really conversant, they have expertise in these capabilities. And that's what's going to change. I think the principles and the concepts, what you can do with it, you know, I think that's what sort of provides that foundation.
Finally, where do you see the future of the industry going?
Now, I think where we see this is the fact that it is going to be so much more pervasive. It's going to be not a novelty, you know, but a tool. And as more and more folks we interface with, literally, are around the world, we see being able to make this interactive approach for communication, not only entertainment, but a way of doing business. And whether it's teaching, whether it's training, whether it's actual operations between a facility for the medical disciplines, it's huge. To be able to have someone, you know, diagnose you from three states away, from a country away. These are real high-impact applications. They're going to build on the same technology. And so when we send a student out from this, yeah, they may have some near-term opportunities in the gaming world, but we think they're going to be making impact across many different businesses, you know, many different types of different areas and disciplines. We think they're going to have that type of impact.
Who knows? Maybe in the future we'll be having interviews via VR.
Well, that's a good point. It's always, you know, we always say, hey, it's great to see someone face-to-face. And, you know, the difference in telepresence communicating now and 5 years ago, it's night and day. You know, to be honest, you know, I think I actually can see people clearer when they're on a 5 foot video screen in front of me than, you know, 10 feet away at the end of a boardroom table. So, I agree. And I think not only interviewing, but actually getting work done because, you know, it's time consuming to jump in a plane and go someplace. And there's just some instances where you can't get that expertise in the same room. Being able to do it virtually, you know, I think that's a real game changer.
Dr. Robert Gere is Senior Vice President and Chief Operating Officer at SUNY Poly in Albany, New York. He spoke with the Best of Our Knowledge's Patrick Garrett. If you'd like to hear more on topics like this, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledge's podcast on all things geek, Retconned. It's available wherever you get your podcasts. Still to come, teachers have to deal with everything from helicopters to snowflakes. That's next on the Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about the Best of Our Knowledge? Well, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. There are good reasons that I produce a program on education instead of going out and, you know, educating people. One of them has to do with qualifications or my lack thereof. The other is explained in a new book by Jane Morris called Teacher Misery, Helicopter Parents, Special Snowflakes, and Other BS. Two things you ought to know here. First, Jane Morris is not her real name. She enjoys getting a paycheck. And BS is not abbreviated in the real title of the book. Now, the book details her experiences with students at a big city school that are at the same time maddening, infuriating, and at times hilarious. I spoke to Ms. Morris about this book and asked, well, is she still teaching? And if so, why?
I do love it. And there's something that is almost a bit addicting about the challenges that you go through. Like, I can't imagine having a regular day job just sitting at a desk. I do think that I would get bored. And the sense of fulfillment that you get when you do see a kid change, get them to care more about their education, or just to be a nicer, more respectful person in general, is very personally fulfilling. Plus, it's hilarious, as you could see in the book. I mean, I'm just laughing all the time, because if I didn't, I'd probably cry. But if you have a good sense of humor, I think so much of what goes on is very funny.
Of the stories and the students that we hear about, please tell me they're a minority, that the majority of students are just kids trying to go about their day.
They're not the majority. The majority of kids are just, they don't really stand out, but they don't really cause trouble. They're just trying to get through the day. But the troublemakers, the difficult kids, there's a lot of them, depending on what school you work in. I think if they come from a more troubled background, more poverty, there's a lot. And the less administration supports teachers, the more kids see that they can get away with that behavior, and the more kids kind of join in. But there are so many really wonderful kids, which I probably should have touched on more in the book, but it is called Teacher Misery, so, you know, it's about the bad parts.
They're not contributing to your misery.
No, I mean, they are the ones that are just amazing human beings and give me hope for humanity. I mean, there are a lot of kids that do so much volunteer work. They travel around the world trying to help people just because they want to and are just really good, caring people. So being there for those kids, you know, definitely keeps me going. And I always tell myself, focus on those kids and try to brush off the nasty ones.
Given the obvious subject matter of the book, your name, as we know it, is not your real name, and you have not identified the school or the school district. I am going to assume, though, this is a larger city, though, right?
It is. It's a large city.
Is this just in the school you were in, or have you taken stories from other teachers in other localities?
Well, I thought what I was experiencing was so outrageous, it had to be just me. But then when I started my Instagram, Teacher Misery, it was teachers following me, thousands and thousands of teachers, and they were all saying, thank you for voicing this. This is what I experienced. Then I started just asking questions on Instagram. Tell me your worst thing that's happened with a parent. Tell me your worst interaction with an administrator. And then the stories that people were telling were just as crazy or crazier than mine. So I started to realize that overall, this is how education is going in this country, that the parents have all the power and they tend to believe their kids more than they believe teachers. And there's just less and less respect for teachers. So the job just keeps getting harder and harder.
My next question was right there. What's the biggest problem, the students or the parents?
So they call it entitlement. There's this term in education, special snowflake, is the kid that has been treated not just special because every kid is special, but that they're better than everyone else and they're entitled to certain treatment. The kids come in with that attitude, expecting things without working for it. They come in with this attitude of you need to earn their respect. Then there's administration that often really, there are no consequences for anything. So it's sort of a twofold issue where the parents blaming the teacher and then administration is not following through with any consequences, which undermines the teacher.
That is something that comes up again over and over in the book. I wrote this student up, nothing happened. What, if anything, can happen?
Well, different schools handle things differently. But that is, again, something that I've talked about with a lot of teachers, where they write a kid up for something outrageous and they have a little chat, if anything. They have a chat with the administrator and it's a friendly chat. And then they come back and what the message that they got was, I can do things like this and nothing will happen. The thing is that schools are so overrun with very big issues that the smaller issues, they have to kind of fall by the wayside, like kids coming late to class. They just don't have the resources to be documenting this and then giving detention and things like that. So there is no consequence for being late. So unless the student is intrinsically motivated or afraid of a phone call home, there really is no reason for them to come to class on time because nothing's going to happen. So we don't even have detention in my school because there's no resources to pay teachers to stay to run detention. The only option that we are given is give your own detention. Keep the kid after school. Make them stay with you however long you want, which to me, that's detention for me.
Yeah, who's being punished right there?
Right.
Can you talk about some things that while you were going through them just made you mad? And now you look back at them and say, well, that was pretty funny. Or does that not happen? You're still mad about them all.
That's a hard one. You know, the thing is, like, even when I go back and look through the book, I start to get angry. I can't reread some of it because I start, all those old feelings start coming up, and I start to feel angry. But I think some things in retrospect maybe wouldn't hurt as much because I've seen so much and I've been doing it for so long. Like the thing I wrote about where it was my first year and really my first couple of weeks as a teacher, and I got an anonymous email, an online conversation posted between two students talking about how they hate me. So a lot of mean things about me. And it's just the cruelty of, why would a kid make up a fake email and send this to me just to hurt me? You know, so at the time I was just crying and kind of rethinking, like, can I handle this job? Because, of course, I didn't think it was going to be quite like that. And I made a very big deal out of it, trying to find out who the email came from. I think now I would immediately get rid of it so that I couldn't read it again and try to brush it off as much as I could.
Jane Morris, not her real name, is the author of Teacher Misery, Helicopter Parents, Special Snowflakes, and Other BS. You can find her on the Teacher Misery page on Instagram or at Teacher Misery on Twitter. Music has power, and sometimes that means the power to make us sad. And that's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Sadness might not be a negative emotion when it comes to music. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Henrika Peltola, university teacher in the Department of Music at the University of Jyväskylä, discusses how emotions are never as simple as sad or happy.
Sadness is counted as one of the basic emotions, which people tend to avoid. In situations involving music, this definition for sadness is not applicable, since music evokes mostly pleasant emotions in the listener. My co-author, Professor Tuomas Eerola from Durham University, and I assumed that this phenomenon appears paradoxical partly because the focus of the previous studies has been too narrow. We analyzed three descriptions of 363 volunteers to explore the variety of emotional experiences that people associate with the kind of music that they consider as sounding sad. The analysis revealed a range of experiences that were classified into three themes. Sweet sorrow consisted of pleasurable experiences that were sought by the listener. The theme covered many strategies for self-regulation, such as getting comfort from the music or relaxation. Similarity between the mood of the listener and the emotional content of the music played a crucial role in making the experience pleasurable. Melancholia consisted of unpleasant experiences that were sometimes avoided by the listener. The emotional experience was linked with personal memories or reflection of listener's own situation, but with negative outcomes as they evoked unpleasant feelings. Grief consisted of highly unpleasant and painful experiences that often led to avoidance of the kind of sad music that was involved in these unwanted experiences. The study revealed important differences in how contextual aspects affect to the emotional experiences induced by sad music. That also seemed to lead to differences in self-regulation processes. Furthermore, it demonstrated that negative emotions do have a place within the experiences of listening to sad music.
That was Henrika Peltola of the University of Jyväskylä. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or any of the other national productions or WAMC podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.